Welcome to the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis of Bemis Hosting.
And Matt Enders with Charter School IT Techs.
This is episode 2. And we're getting better at this thing, I think. We got a couple mic stands so it's not sitting on the table.
So we're going to eliminate that thump, thump, thump every time I don't pay attention and bang the table.
Yeah, as long as you don't stick your foot out and then
kick the mic stand.
Yeah, I just did that.
All right. Are you ready for the kernel news, Tony?
I am. Let's go for it.
All right. The kernel current release status is, the current development kernel is 3.1-RC10. It was released on October 17th. There hasn't been much going on. There were some small MIPS updates, or the bulk of this release candidate, and the rest are some small driver fixes and some last-minute ButterFS and XFX fixes. Expect the final 3.1 release sometime in the near future. Stable updates. The 3.0.7 update was released on October 17th with a moderately sized set of important fixes. 42 existing files in the kernel were changed, 262 new files were inserted into the kernel, and 302 old files were deleted from the kernel. Greg Crow Hartman at SUSE had this to say about the current stable release. I've had some boot problems with this kernel, and I can't seem to narrow the issue down, but I think it's due to something not related to the kernel itself, but I am not positive. Please test to verify that I didn't mess something up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because Greg is the stable maintainer, so
oh.
If it's not booting for him, there might be problems.
Right.
And then the 2011 Kernel Summit draft agenda is posted. It will be held on October 24th and 25th in Prague. The draft agenda has been posted at http://ksummit2011.kernel.org/agenda.
All right.
That's all I have for the kernel news, Tony.
You were talking about the first section during the development release. You said there were MIPS updates.
Yeah.
What is that?
MIPS is it's an operating system. It's a not an operating system. It's a processor. MIPS processor.
Okay, MIPS processor. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the bulk of the updates in the release candidate. The rest were some minor driver updates, and then at the very last second, they threw some ButterFX and XFS updates in there.
Right. All right, cool. So, are we on to distro news?
We are on to distro news, sir.
Got a couple releases this week. A couple since our last recording, too, for last week, was Linux, L-I-N-E-X, and Puppy. Puppy's a pretty popular Linux distro. I know that for, what, PS3 uses Puppy?
Yeah, I've used Puppy on some lightweight hardware.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's okay.
Must work good on the Atom processors, because that's what the PS3 has. What, they have like 5 or 6 Atom processors stacked on it?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I haven't used it in a long time, and when I did use it, it was just on straight Intel hardware.
All right. Cool.
So, but it worked okay. As far as lightweight distributions go, I personally think you can't beat Vector.
Yeah, and that was released last week, right?
Yes, they did.
So this week, we have FreeNAS 8.2 or 8.02 was released.
FreeNAS, that's based on BSD, right?
I believe so.
Is it FreeBSD or which one of them?
Yes, FreeBSD-based operating system providing a free network-attached storage services.
Yeah, I keep meaning to look at that.
Josh Pretzel, P-A-E-T-Z-E-L, is the one that announced it. He says there's some bug fixes and just general updates to the project. And let's see, more Sabian 7 cores released this week also.
Whatever that means.
Yeah.
And Sabian, isn't that based on like Gen 2?
I was trying to look and I couldn't.
All those other freaks over there? Sorry if you're a Gen 2 user, but you know you're a freak.
But the LinuxToday.com, they did a review on it, and he compared KDE and GNOME and XFCE. He said with XFCE, it was booted, just running that was the PC was using 200 megs of RAM. He said that was a little bit higher, but he didn't go through to figure out why it was higher than what he expected.
Yeah, I just switched. Like last week, we had some discussion about how I was using LXD for my desktop, but I was using Debian Mint, and Debian Mint doesn't really support LXDE, so I did a reload this week, and I'm running XFCE now on the desktop, and it's not running very lightweight. And I don't think that they meant for it to be lightweight. I think they just meant for it to be an alternative, because it loads just about every GNOME library in the universe.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why it's running heavy.
Right, but, yeah, that's got to be it, because, and then XFCE, like you said, all the menus and stuff, I mean, originally, if you want to be lightweight, you don't have any of those menus and stuff running. Although it's not as user friendly,
right?
So we're the users are tied to Moore's law, that the hardware goes up, so programmers program for the harder, better hardware, so people with older stuff get stuck with slow machines.
Yep, that's just the way it works, unless you run Vector.
You like it that much?
Hey, I used to use it on some old stuff. I mean, this was probably about 5 years ago, but these were 486s.
Wow.
5 years ago. And it was running really well with 16 megs of RAM. And
yeah,
it was a nice piece of stuff. I don't know what they've done with it in the last 5 years. But back when I used to use it, it was nice stuff.
I have a couple 1 gig laptops. I should try them on those.
Yeah, I think you'd be impressed with it. Now you got to remember, they do two different distributions. They do the Soho, the small office home office distribution,
mm-hmm.
and then they do their regular distribution. And the regular distribution is the one you want for the older hardware.
Oh,
not,
okay.
Not the Soho.
Ah, yeah. Also released this week is Black Panther OS 11.1. It's based on Mandriva.
Okay, I have a question.
From Hungarian.
If you're based on Mandriva, which is nowhere near release 11.1, how do you have a release of 11.1?
That's a good question. So, maybe they go through and make improvements that Mandriva doesn't do.
Okay.
Because they say they've improved in fixes for updates since beta, obviously. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a full release. They have 10 official repositories with over 10,000 packages available. Anyway, that's all I know about Black Panther as a distro. And then there's Kora, K-O-R-O-A-A, Linux 15.1. They are a Fedora-based distro. And they were released today, today being Thursday the 20th. Yeah.
Cool.
Let's see. I had.
Any distro quotes or anything for us there, Tony?
Distros of the week.
Oh, the distros just of the week.
Hit count for the websites.
There we go.
Ubuntu, number one. Then Mint. Lubuntu. Fedora and Debian.
By the way, Ubuntu's down. Mint is up. Look out, Ubuntu. That's all I have to say.
How did they go down with the big release last week?
Well, because people are catching on, that's how.
No, you must be looking at are you looking at the 6 months?
Last 7 days.
Oh, I'm looking at the 6 months right now. Yeah. Yeah, last 7 days, they're down. All right. And then, did you know Mint? They're developing for GNOME 3.
I saw that. Mint Debian is also, they're developing for GNOME 3 because Mint Debian is available with GNOME or XFCE.
Oh, okay.
Regular Mint, you can get GNOME, KDE, or LXDE.
Yeah. They're saying, though, they're not going to make it the default. They're going to stick with the 2.3.2 as the default.
Is there anybody out there basically going to keep the 2. Series of GNOME alive? Because like there's some guys out there that have kept the KDE 3. Series alive with some repositories and things. So
actually, Linus put a ask out there or whatever, put a flag out there saying that, or asking for people to do a fork of GNOME 2.
Oh, really?
Because he doesn't like GNOME 3 so much that he said he wants another alternative.
Well, I think it's out. I think you've got the other alternatives out there. You just have to get behind them, like LXDE. I really like LXDE, but it just was working kind of flaky on the Mint Debian. So that's why I'm trying the XFCE now, which I have used before in the past on other things, so it's not totally new to me.
Yeah.
But that's also another alternative is LX, you know, and depending on how much work the distro puts into it, as long as you're not just throwing raw XFCE at the user, it can be a nice experience.
Oh, yeah. I agree. All right, that's what I have for the distros. Do you have anything else?
I do. I have some articles that I thought were interesting this week. The first one is going to be on Secure Boot. I entitled it Secure Boot or Restricted Boot. So, have you heard at all about the Secure Boot thing, Tony?
I've heard a few things.
Have you? It's not really new. It's actually been going on since June, the discussion on it.
Yeah.
So, but it's actually coming to a head right now. And there's a lot of misinformation going out there. But this is what is not misinformation. In order to get a Win8 certificate for the hardware, it has to ship with Secure Boot enabled. Win8 certification does not require that Secure Boot be able to be disabled by the end user, and many hardware manufacturers are already saying that disabling will not be an end user option.
Really?
Win8 certification does not require that the system ship with any other keys other than the Microsoft keys, and when a system ships with Secure Boot enabled, with the ability to disable it turned off, and only includes the Microsoft keys, then only Microsoft OSs will boot on that hardware. The problem is not the Secure Boot itself, as that actually is a pretty good thing, and it's being worked on in some Linux. Some Linux people are looking at it anyway to use it. The problem is with the keys and who controls them. Will the manufacturer control them, and only they will say what boots? Will the end user be given control and allowed to say what boots? This is the real issue. If it's the end user, then there's really no issue. However, if the key holder is the manufacturer, then we are looking at a future where the only OS that will boot on new hardware will be Windows. At least in the consumer commodity market, which is where this is aimed, not the server market. The FSF has released a statement on Secure Boot that explains this issue very clearly. You can find that post at www.fsf.org/campaign/secure-boot-vs-restricted-boot. How's that for a URL?
It's in the notes. So just go to smlr.us and... for episode 2.
And I would like if you would please sign their petition, also located at www.fsf.org/campaigns/secure-boot-vs-restricted-boot/statement.
And for those that out there can't type as fast as Matt can talk, that's also in the show notes.
Oh, and by the my daughter listened to the last episode and told me I have to slow my ass down.
It was probably the whole UTC at 1080.66.
There has also been some excellent insight into this written by Matthew Garrett, of Red Hat. His blog is at mjg59.dreamwidth.org. And finally, a quote from Ed Bott, who completely misses the point. Allow me to illustrate by turning the argument around in an equally cynical way with an equally inflammatory rhetorical flourish. People who make their living in the Linux ecosystem are demanding that Microsoft disable a key security feature planned for Windows 8 so that malware authors can continue to infect those PCs and drive their owners to alternate operating systems. Oh wait, now that I think about it, that's actually pretty close to the truth. Ed's blog can be read in its entirety here at www.zdnet.com/blog/bot. The article with the offensive quote and attitude is entitled, Why Do Linux Fanatics Want to Make Windows 8 Less Secure? What a Microsoft stooge if there ever was one. Oops, did I say that out loud? Now for my opinion, which is why I do this podcast. I'm not opposed to Secure Boot if the end user is given control. The vast majority of end users will never mess with it and leave it intact because guess who owns over 90% of the desktop market already? Microsoft. That's not going to change. I don't understand their paranoia. Okay? The question remains, are we a large enough audience to make the manufacturers take notice? Please sign the FSF petition mentioned earlier. If you missed, we will have a link in the show notes. What do you think, Tony?
I think that this is crap. You know, I mean, they need to let the end users either have some way that either it pulls, you can update the certs or the keys or whatever they're going to have, Because you got to have more than just one. I mean, Microsoft isn't going to have one key that's going to last until the hardware dies. You know, somebody's going to hack it. They're going to have to send out a new key, and then all of a sudden, none of their Windows are going to boot, or none of their machines are going to boot. You know, or you're going to run a Windows update.
Well, at that time, what they could force you to do is a BIOS update at that point, and then Grandma's going to have to figure out how to flash her freaking BIOS.
Right.
You know, that's never going to happen.
No, but then at that point, then if there's an application to flash up the BIOS, then there's going to be keys for us to flash to have, you know, or the virus, it's going to get in and flash the BIOS before it writes, and then you reboot, and then all of a sudden it's booting from the virus.
Yeah, as long as the end user is given some type of control either to manage the keys or to just turn it off completely, I'm not opposed to it. It actually makes a lot of sense if you're running Microsoft products who are based on a 1960s attitude, which was before the internet and before all this malware. I mean, they just need to get current so that malware writers can't really attack their OS the way they have been. So,
yeah, I agree. Yeah, the rest of the world has to adapt because Microsoft can't write.
Can't write a modern operating system.
Right. So. Jeez. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot of people that have been talking about this, and I agree. It's a bad thing.
The best information I liked was Matt Garrett from Red Hat. I thought he put it together the most succinctly. He has, like, several blog posts on it, and he did a really nice job. So, yeah, if you guys want to read some really good stuff about it, go out and read Matt Garrett's blog.
Nice. All right, did you know that LibreOffice, they're going to be developing for ports for Android, so you can have full LibreOffice on your phone, also for the web.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Oh, so it's going to be like a live type of a Google type of a Docs kind of a thing?
Yeah, Google Docs, but
LibreOffice.
Yeah, that's really exciting because that's what I was looking into that. I wanted to try to run something like that, and everything I found out there is all pay services right now.
Right. Well, Google Docs isn't.
It isn't, right, but then you have to, everything has to live on Google servers.
Sure.
And then it's not your own documents anymore.
Yeah.
So if you want to run your own server, it's like, say you're at a school and you have a low bandwidth, then your own your doc server right here that everybody connects into, and then you don't have to pay per seat license to Microsoft to have Office available.
True. But we use LibreOffice here at the school, and I try and convince most of my clients to use LibreOffice just because it makes sense.
It does. It's very nice. I was using it just a little bit ago. All right, did you hear about the ICANN? They're taking over for the Olson time zone database?
I did. That's actually my next article.
Oh, it is? Why don't you talk about it?
Okay. It's because the time zone database was attacked, but it finds a new home. And the time zone database is pretty important to most computer users. Whether they realize it or not, Unix and Unix-like OSs keep their internal time in Unix time, which is the number of seconds since midnight January 1st, 1970. It then uses the selection of the user about where they are located in the world to convert that time into a usable time for their applications. So there is a TZ database maintained by Arthur David Olson and Paul Egert, with the data hosted by Olson and Egert's employer, the U.S. National Institute of Health, along with the TZ public mailing list, to discuss and announce changes to the data. The problem arises in the form of a lawsuit filed by Astrolabe Incorporated, a purveyor of commercial astrology charts, books, and software.
Astrology.
The lawsuit accuses Olson and Egbert of unlawful reproduction of data from the ACS Atlas and of having wrongfully and unlawfully asserted that the information and or date sick taken from the works is public domain. That's because it shouldn't say date, it should say data, but in their filing they had a typo and didn't catch it. So that shows you the intelligence of Astrolabe and their attorneys. The lawsuit came as a shock to the TZ database community as well as the Unix community in general, in part because the suit claims that including facts from the book in the database deprives the publisher of income, when the references to the AC Atlas in the comments actually encourage its use. The bigger problem here is that Astrolabe is asserting that the facts listed in this book are protected by copyright. This should be a matter of settled law, as the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on several occasions that facts are not copyrightable, even if the author has taken great effort to compile these facts. See Feist v. Rural and Worth v. Selcho and Writer Company. That last one's actually pretty interesting. I was reading a little bit of that one.
Yeah.
The first one, Feist versus Rural, that's just a couple of different phone book companies arguing about who has the right to the data of this is Matt Enders and my phone number, or Tony Bemis and this phone number. But the other one is kind of nifty. It was the suit was filed by Worth, who originally made this computer trivia game back in whenever. And Seclo and Writer Company are the makers of Trivial Pursuit. Well, they reverse engineered his computer game. And they verbatim copied his question and answers out and put them on cards for Trivial Pursuit.
Oh, wow.
And he lost. Because really? They're just facts. And you can't copyright facts.
Oh.
Even though they had to reverse engineer his software to get those facts, they're still just facts.
Hmm.
So it doesn't look good for Astrolabe.
No. No, that's good. And because, I mean, what is Astrolabe going to make money off of people trying to see what time zone they're
exactly, in? Exactly.
Their books aren't even made for that. I'm sure there's probably noted in there what time zones are where.
Well, but. And Astrolabe didn't write the book they're even talking about. It was written by another company that went Chapter 11, and they bought their intellectual property.
Oh.
So.
Back into that kind of thing again.
Yeah, Astrolabe is just doing total patent trolling here. Total patent trolling. The good thing is that ICANN stepped in and has taken over hosting responsibilities for the TZ database. ICANN cited a request to take over administration of the database from the Internet Engineering Task Force, and quotes ICANN Chief Operating Officer Akram Atala as saying, "The time zone database provides an essential service to the Internet, and keeping it operational falls within ICANN's mission of maintaining a stable and dependable Internet." It does not mention the lawsuit. Although ZDNet Australia quoted ICANN's Kim Davies as saying, "We are aware of the lawsuit and will deal with any legal matters as they arise." Basically telling Astrolabe that, look, now you're going to be dealing with ICANN and we just don't think you can do it. So
that's right. Yeah, now we're the big player in there.
Yep. My thoughts are, how did this lawsuit get past the filing stage? As its only claim is that the facts are copyrighted, which is very evidently a matter of settled law, as evidenced in the above-mentioned U.S. Supreme Court cases, along with many others not mentioned.
Yeah, after that, I agree. It's nothing to worry about. Jeez. So another thing I ran over, I didn't run over it, I guess. I found it.
Came across.
That's a good one. It's not really news related, but there's an article in the Linux Today about running ISP config 3 on Ubuntu 11.10. Have you ever heard of that?
No. What is ISP config?
It's a system, and on the website, it was telling you how to prepare a Ubuntu 11.10 server for the installation of ISP config 3. What it is it's a web hosting control panel that allows you to configure the following services through a web browser: Apache web server, PostFix mail server, MySQL, Bind or MyDNS name server, Pure FTPD, Spam Assassin, Clam AV, and many other ones.
So is it written in Perl?
Don't know. I didn't get that far into it.
Because if it were written in Perl, it'd be Webmin.
Yeah, it sounds just like Webmin, except for... it does. It sounds just like Webmin.
It does. It sounds exactly like Webmin, which I've been using on servers for years, and it's fine.
They're really toting it up, though. I wanted to look into it more. If there's anybody out there that's run this or knows more about it, let us know what you guys think about it. Apparently, there's ISP config monitoring apps for Android too. That's about it for my notes. You have anything else?
I'm all done.
You know, there's some projects and stuff I was thinking about, but
oh, speaking of projects, I finally got PFSense to load.
Sweet.
I used a different machine. What I can't figure out is this machine, when it first loads, it tells me that the geometry is off, but then when I hit the quick install thing, it just goes right ahead and does it. So there's got to be a flaky drive or something in that other machine.
Yeah, that's got to be it.
That's borking it out. but it looks sweet. I'm telling you, the user interface on it is just incredible. I'm actually thinking about buying the book.
It's awesome.
And the nice thing about it too is it's U.S. based, buddy. It's written by a couple of guys in Louisville, Kentucky.
So, oh yeah,
yeah.
Wow. Made in the USA.
It looks really like sweet. I got to run it at home right now in kind of a test environment. I just have it on my network, and I'm using the network feed from my network at home as the WAN.
Yeah.
And then I've got two other cards in there that I'm using as LAN ports. And I only got one of them hot, and I've got it hooked up to an old Cisco 24-port switch that I'm hooking other devices into.
All right.
To test it out. It's working. It's passing the internet through perfectly. It's working real nice, and the configuration is just incredibly easy with their user interface.
Awesome. You know, I've been looking for a Linux base or BSD based firewall that does trunking, trunking from the router into like a Cisco switch, because what that allows you to do is
trunking is where you aggregate multiple cards into one appears as one interface. Is that what you mean by trunking?
No, actually, it's using one interface and appears to be multiple interfaces, so it's opposite. So what it allows you to do,
like with VLANs,
VLANing, yeah. So what it allows you to do is you have one interface on the router that goes to the switch, and then on the switch it's split up into multiple VLANs. And then you can manage from there.
Because pfSense has VLAN trunking.
Oh, awesome.
Right there. It's in their official docs. It's doc.pfSense.org/index.php/VLAN_trunking.
Sweet. And then what's the hardware requirements for pfSense?
You know, I couldn't find them anywhere. But the machine I was trying to install them on had 2 gigs of RAM and like a 2 gigahertz processor. But the machine I actually have it running on now has got 1 gig of RAM and a 1 gigahertz processor. So it's nothing smoking, honking fast.
Yeah. Actually, I went to their website, pfSense.org.
Yeah.
And it says right on their hardware, minimum requirements. And it says a 100 megahertz processor.
Where did you find that? I looked earlier.
And 128 megs of RAM.
Where did you see that?
pfSense.org.
And then, I'm at pfSense. I'm at the docs.
Yeah, and that's where you can also check. It says for hard drive space.
Like 10 gigs of
RAM. It just says a gig of RAM. I guess it all depends what you want to do. If you want to do caching and stuff, you probably need more space. But also, you won't be able to run a 100 megahertz processor on a corporate LAN. So, yeah, like a dual core.
Yeah.
You know, multi.
Oh, yeah, there it is. I obviously didn't look hard enough because it's right in front of me.
Yeah, 2 gigs of RAM. That's, if you're going to run a corporate router, you have to have something like that.
Yeah, but they have images, though, for embedded systems, too. So you're not going to find embedded systems with that much stuff.
No, you're right. But. Yeah, cool.
But yeah, it's really, really nice stuff. They're going to actually do some U.S. training for it too. After the EuroBSD Con, which they've done stuff at the last 4 EuroBSD Cons.
Yeah.
So.
Sweet.
They actually in their forum section posted up, hey, how many people would be interested? You know, what do you think fair pricing would be? So far, they're getting tons of hits back saying tons of people are interested, and the fair pricing is coming back for a 2-day session of between $350 and $750 bucks.
Oh, wow.
So, not too bad.
Yeah, I know for business, that'd be cheap.
Yeah.
If you're sending your IT security guy out there or something.
Right, right.
But for your layman, that's
well, and I don't necessarily know that, you know, Sam Snead needs to go to and get... Yeah. Official training from pfSense just to run it at his house. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see that.
And their book, from what I understand, that's what I'm actually considering buying the book. It is fairly comprehensive, if you can believe their advertising, which why would they lie?
Right. That's cool. So I've got this another project I'm working on at home, and I'm trying to get my media server running, and I've been using Linux MCE, and I really like it, but I've been having all sorts of problems. I thought there was just, it was flaky, and ends up being my hardware. It was an old machine. I reloaded with another media type server. It had the same problems. Different OS, so I know that it's a hardware problem. So I got another computer. It's a dual core. I'm gonna put a couple gigs of RAM in it and with all my hard drives, and I'm gonna go back to Linux MCE. I really like it. The only thing I have to look for and see if they have any plugins for like DLNA. And then
what's DLNA?
It's a way for media streaming throughout your home network. PS3, or not maybe PS3, but the Xbox 360 has it, where you can stream from your PC to it, and then you can watch your movies or your videos, your listen to your music across it.
The only thing I use Xbox for is my Netflix account.
Yeah.
Because Netflix, come on. Make a Linux client. Just do it. You've got one for Android. It's the same thing. Make a Linux client.
Yeah, you know that you can.
Yeah, if they're building a client for Android, you know they can make a Linux client, because they are, because they're making one for Android.
It's got to be something about DRM.
It's totally DRM.
Yeah.
So, because I don't have the Netflix account where they send you videos. I have only the streaming account, because I'm a cheap bastard.
Did you hear they went back? They were gonna split it up with Quickster. Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
Everybody that had both, and they went ahead, and it was, I don't know, it was like $10 a month for both, or $7 a month for both.
No, because just streaming is like $8 something a month.
Oh, really? Maybe it wasn't much more. I don't know. But then they came out and said, no, if you want to keep both, it's gonna be like a total combined of like $19. It's gonna like double the price of what they were charging. And they lost like a million customers. So they said if you're not gonna be streaming at all, just go to Quickster. That's our new DVD sending out company, and then you can drop down to that price. But if you want streaming, then you're gonna have to buy the Netflix service for streaming. And my parents have it, and they're like, oh well, we don't stream, so we'll just get Quickster. But apparently there's enough people out there who are so upset that they just dropped it. And then I think about 2 weeks after they had made that announcement, they went back. They said, okay, we're not going to make any price changes. We're not going to separate it out. And they just dropped the whole Quickster thing. Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just used the streaming. Granted, you're not getting the first run stuff on the streaming. It's good enough for me.
Yeah.
I'm just watching those foreign unrated stuff anyway.
Nice. But on the Linux MCE, back to that a little bit, mm-hmm. There's the Hulu player for desktop, and that's available on Linux MCE, and that's what we've been watching for a while. If you do the free account, then you don't get all the TV show episodes, you just get like the last five. Certain ones, they have all of them posted. You don't get all the movies, you just get like the old and straight to video movies. Or you can pay $10 a month and get stream anything that they have, plus I think anything that one of their other partner services run. And it's all through their desktop. So that's pretty cool. It worked really nice. We were using it. Like I said, I was it was running on some old hardware, so that was a little laggy. But I liked it.
Buffering.
No, it was processor, because it runs in Flash. I think it's still built in all Flash.
Okay.
And I was running on a...
And Flash video, I tell you right now from experience, from troubleshooting some stuff at the school here, Flash video is very, very, very processor intensive.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and that was what was going on, because I was using like a single core 2.6, and it would play for like a minute and then hang there for a minute and then play for a while and hang. And then I went and tried it on my desktop. And it's a dual core with 4 gigs of RAM, and it ran played through fine, no problems. So that's what these new machines I'm going to put in. It's going to be all dual cores. It'll be nice.
Cool.
Any other projects you're working on?
No, I'm just looking at that. The only thing I'm working on right now is that PF Sense thing, and now that I finally got it to load on some hardware, it's looking like it's going to be really doable. I want to put it in use at a customer's as a test environment, you know, first. Got to find a customer that'll let me do that. I'll do it for them free of charge, obviously, but I want to get it in a live environment. And I'm working on them here at the school, but they're real happy with that Natopia device. But if I can find a way to turn all the functions of that Natopia device off so it's just a pass-through, acts as a pass-through modem, then I might just try it here and not tell them.
Well, doesn't it have, it has all filtering and everything so you can filter out for it so kids aren't messing with it? Or kids aren't getting to bad websites? And
it does. It's got, you can do, but we use, I here at the school, we use OpenDNS. We have an OpenDNS account, so, because if you're a K-12, you can get a free OpenDNS account and do all your filtering there at OpenDNS.
Okay.
And with the free educational account, you can lock it down so hard that they really can't go much of anywhere. Or you can open it up, and then there's also the ability to whitelist 25 sites and blacklist 25 sites. So.
Only 25?
Yeah.
So that's when
25 of
each. Good. Right. So. But yeah, I mean, you can still run that on the PF along with next to PF Sense, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Because your Netopia is not logging into their website.
No. It's just the DHCP server is just passing the OpenDNS.
Yeah. How do they know it's you guys? Is it coming from a specific IP?
Yes. I tell them that the traffic's all going to be coming. Our traffic comes from this specific IP. You have to tell them that when you set the account up.
Oh, okay. So. That makes sense. I think we're just over 35 minutes right now. And it's running a little shorter than we thought we would.
So, I don't know. I'm happy with a 35-minute one.
Yeah, all right.
All right.
Hey, and all of our listeners out there, if you have some interviews you want to listen to, go ahead and tell us who you want to listen to, and then we'll find them and interview them.
Well, we'll see if they'll talk to us. Let's put it that way.
Like you're who? Anyway. All right. This is Tony Bemis from Bemis Hosting.
And Matt Enders from Charter School IT Tech saying, until next time.
That's it.